Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So what is the worst scandal in Major League Baseball? And what changes could the Rays deploy to make it harder for the next round of cheaters? And which Buccaneer made the most improvement last season? LSU scored 42 points versus Clemson's defense. Was Clemson overrated or LSU just that good? We've got all your mailbag questions answered 100% correctly on this edition of Sports Day Tampa Bay. I'm Rick Stroud of the Tampa Bay Times, along with producer Steve Versnick. All right, we're joined now by Mike Henry, the publicity assistant at Tampa Bay Downs, a longtime friend of mine, former Tampa Tribune reporter as well. Hey, Mike, we got some exciting things going on at Tampa Bay Downs this weekend, starting with the Skyway Festival Day. Tell me about it.
Well, hello, Rick. We are expecting a pretty spectacular day of racing Saturday. We're going to have three stakes races worth a combined $300,000 in purse money. And a couple of them are three-year-old races, so it's a chance for horses that just turned three to get out and show that they have the goods to continue on this year onto bigger and better things. The stakes races involved are the 20th edition of the $125,000 Pasco Stakes for three-year-old colts and geldings, the 36th running of the Gasparilla Stakes for three-year-old fillies, also worth $125,000, and the 36th running of the $50,000 Wayward Last Stakes, which is for older fillies and mares. All points to a great day of racing.
Yeah, the weather's supposed to be great. It should be exciting thoroughbred racing there at Tampa Bay Downs. You also have an exciting event coming up called College Day with a chance for some college and high school students to win scholarships.
Well, this is the second year we're doing our College Day promotion, and the beauty of it is that it's open to all college junior, sophomore, and freshman students, as well as high school seniors who are planning to enroll in college. The way it works is that on Saturday, they'll come to the track and fill out an entry form. We will then select at random 25 finalists who will be asked to submit an essay discussing ways that they feel horse racing can be marketed to a new generation of fans. And the purpose of the contest is to try to get new ideas for marketing and to get younger people involved. The top five essays will be chosen, and those five will all win $2,000 scholarships.
Well, that's exciting, and what a great partner that Tampa Bay Downs has been for the community and helping students, of course, both college and high school students. Hey, Mike, there's a lot of thoroughbred racing. That's what Tampa Bay Downs is known for. You mentioned the stakes racing. Of course, there is thoroughbred racing 4 days a week, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The gates open at 11 a.m., post time at 12:25. But there's also other things to do at Tampa Bay Downs as well, right?
Well, there are a lot of things to do here. Our Silks Poker Room has no limits play and tournament action 7 days a week. And then our golf facility, the Downs Golf Facility, is open every day as well. And I'm looking out the window right now at it, and there's a lot of people lined up hitting balls. So that's why we call it the multi-entertainment destination. We think there's something for everybody.
And you can call Tampa Bay Downs at 813-855-4401. All right, before we get started with your questions, some news that we can discuss a little bit since we've last talked on the podcast. The Red Sox and Alex Cora mutually agreed to part ways. Their manager, of course, that was caught up in the web of the Houston Astros as their bench coach during this instant replay, or I guess not replay, actually. It was a videotape stealing of the signs and they're relaying it to their hitters. So he steps down as manager of the Red Sox. I don't know that this is the end of it, Steve. I mean, I still think that there could be, more information coming out about whether he brought this technique to the Red Sox as well and whether the ownership there will be, punished much the way the Houston Astros were.
Well, I the Red Sox are now under investigation for the 2018 World Series and using technology to cheat as well or steal signs. So it certainly looks like he is guilty in both cases. We'll wait for baseball's investigation to know for sure in Boston. But I think Boston just, you know, look, after what the owner of the Astros did by firing Hinch and Luhnow, it mm-hmm. had to come. And you know, obviously, Chaim Bloom's a new GM in Boston, so you're not going to fire a GM up there. Right. Dave Dombrowski was already let go last year. So, for Chaim Bloom, it's kind of a fresh start at this point.
Yeah. Well, I know they thought a lot of Cora, but, you know, it shouldn't be too hard to find a Red Sox manager. And in some ways, you know, for Chaim Bloom, it's kind of nice to be able to start with your own guy, right? He'll have a chance to go out and hire his guy. And wouldn't surprise me if he had some Rays ties. I mean, I don't know who's available at this point, but that might not be a bad thing. Obviously, they have a good ball club, and they're going to be in contention. But it'll be interesting to see if there's going to be more repercussions applied to the Red Sox. I'm getting a lot, you know, we'll discuss this. I'm sure there are questions about this in our podcast on the mailbag. But it is interesting that, you know, whether or not baseball went far enough. I think that's going to be sort of what everybody's talking about. And I'm just a firm believer they did not. I don't know. You know, I know they probably had to have some immunity with the players in order to find out the information. And so maybe that's why, you know, they didn't hammer them individually or collectively or whatnot. But, you know, I'm still getting lots of people, you know, wondering whether they should vacate the World Series title. I mean, you're not going to give it to the Dodgers, obviously, but you could vacate it. You could make it so that the Astros can't claim that as theirs. You know, and for me, I mean, I still don't know why they didn't consider a postseason ban, because that would hurt ownership. And I just don't think the $5 million and serving up a manager and a GM on the hot coals and forfeiting some draft picks, which you can make up for in free agency, is necessarily enough punishment for the organization. But,
well, I wonder, time
will tell.
A postseason ban would punish the players as well.
It would. That's a good
and
point,
And would the
too.
Union fight that?
They probably would.
And collectively bargaining-wise, could they even do that? I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. But if you had a postseason ban, every one of those Astros players under contract are gonna file an appeal or a grievance with the union.
Well, you know what I'm waiting for is for somebody to file a grievance over their arbitration being affected by hitters guessing what they're throwing, you know, and their ERAs being artificially enhanced.
Or how about the Dodgers losing two World Series to both these teams?
Yeah. Yeah, how about that? Yeah. So, you know, there's probably a lot of incentive bonuses that weren't paid out to managers and maybe even players, right, that didn't win World Series. I mean, I don't know what these contracts, how incentivized they are, but I do know that when players go to arbitration, they look hard at their numbers to compare them to other players. And if I'm getting lit up by the Houston Astros because they're stealing signs electronically and then relaying them to their hitters, I'm a little ticked off. You cost me some money and my legacy, you know, because I pitched against you in the World Series, and so now my postseason record is different. So there's a lot of, you know, sort of damages that this has caused to players and of course to baseball in particular. But yeah, it's such a terrible episode, and we'll talk more about it. I know we got some questions about the scandals and things, but yeah. So now Alex Cora is gone, and the Red Sox need a manager, and we'll find out if there are maybe even more teams. Who knows if more teams were involved in this or not? The other big news of the day yesterday, after our podcast, is that Luke Kuechly, the outstanding middle linebacker for the Carolina Panthers, surprised everybody by announcing his own retirement. And, you know, he played 8 seasons, which, you know, certainly you thought he was capable of playing a lot more to high level, which he's always played. And, you know, just a guy that almost as a rookie, you know, he managed to win Rookie of the Year and then was, I think, the next year maybe Defensive Player of the Year or something like that. I mean, he was that talented. A guy that could diagnose plays. The thing I remember is how offensive coaches would always talk about, in particular, guys like Lovie Smith and Bruce Arians and others, talked about how Kuechly would recognize formations and call out the plays that you were running. It had to be disconcerting for an offense and for a quarterback when, you know, you're at the line of scrimmage and he's actually telling his communicating to his other players what you're running. He was a film junkie, and he was a guy that, you know, not the biggest guy in the world, but, man, he'd come downhill and he'd hit you. Now, unfortunately, if you watch his, you know, his announcement, he gets to a point where he talks about how he wants to continue playing. This is not a willful type thing. He loves football. That's all he's known. He loves playing football more than anything else he could ever do. But he breaks. He gets a little emotional and says, you know, I simply, you know, can't play fast and hard the way I need to play. And we know that he has a history of concussions, and it would be maybe presumptuous to jump straight to that conclusion, but I think it's hard not to consider that this is a health-related decision, you know, that if you're unable to play, there must be a physical component to this, because mentally he wants for all the world to continue, and he talked about how agonizing it was to come to this conclusion, but... you know, he's a guy that's had those concussions, and I think, you know, you're going to see more and more players, Steve, I believe, take, you know, as Marshawn Lynch mentioned the other day, take care of your mentals, you know, mm-hmm. take care of your mentals and your chicken. And they're making a lot of chicken these days. You know?
I believe Keekly, he played 8 years. I believe he made around $60 million.
Yeah. So they're making plenty of chicken, mm-hmm. and now it comes down to taking care of the mentals. And I think you're going to see more and more players have shorter careers, even great players. And we've seen that, right? I mean, Andrew Luck, you know, walked away, got tired of the physicality of having to come rehab from shoulders and different things that he was dealing with. You know, Patrick Willis, going even further back, has very, very similar numbers, almost identical to Luke Kuechly. And he walked away from the game after 8 seasons. So, this is going to be more and more the norm, not like Larry Fitzgerald, who just re-signed for another season with the Arizona Cardinals. I think you're going to see guys leaving the game, you know, particularly the ones that have made money, sooner and sooner, because it is a real threat to your livelihood and to your mm-hmm. and just to your being with the punishment that these guys take.
Well, I think you're seeing a lot more college players leave early, too.
Yes.
You know, if I can start making that money a year earlier...
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in certain positions like running back,
yes,
or that, you know, where you take a punishment, the earlier you can start making your money, the earlier you can retire.
That's correct.
And you know, save your mentals or your chicken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all works together. And, you know, I don't know what Kuechly will do. He'll be good at it. He's a very well-spoken guy. He could do broadcasting. He could be a coach. He could work in a front office. I think he'll do something in football, because he just has so much passion for the game, and he'd be a hell of a coach if he decided to go that route.
So, imagine him as a defensive coordinator.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, I mean he's already. I mean that's what he was on the field. Mm-hmm. I mean he was. You know, you talk about the coach on the field, but he was the literal coach on the field that could take all that classroom, all that film study, and in real time, you know, be dissecting plays before they're run. I mean, what an advantage!
Just put him on the sideline in your defensive player's headset.
Exactly.
Put him on the mic with it.
Absolutely. No, he could certainly do it. Different perspective, but he could certainly do it. So I expect we'll hear from him. But that's a big blow, too, to Carolina. And, you know, I mean, the same time that Luke Kuechly entered the league, so did Lavonte David. And those two, you know, the Bucs could have gone either way. And I just think that, you know, David has had a career that's sort of been a little overshadowed, predominantly because he was an outside linebacker and in terms of Pro Bowls, where Kuechly went to a ton of these Pro Bowls. Lavonte, I think, went to one, and the reason is that the voting was skewed. You know, they considered 3-4 defensive ends as outside linebackers. That's like saying Jason Pierre-Paul, you know, is or Shaq Barrett against, you know, Lavonte David. Well, they don't play the same position. They're not really, even though he's denoted as an outside linebacker, he's really a pass rusher. He's an edge rusher. And so they didn't have that category in the Pro Bowl. So for years and years and years, you know, there'd be a bunch of guys with, you know, 15, 16 sacks that would knock Lavonte David out of the Pro Bowl simply because they didn't play the same position. So I think it's been unfair to Lavonte when his career is over. But if you look at their numbers, his numbers are very similar to Kuechly's. I think he's maybe 80-something tackles shy. Both of them have over 1,000 tackles in their career. And, you know, so, you know, that's going to take a bite out of the Carolina Panthers. I mean, I know they have a whole new, you know, regime with Matt Rhule, and they've got to decide on the quarterback, and there's a lot of transition going on in Carolina. But that's a tough piece to lose. And you've seen the tributes on Twitter and other places, the respect that he had among his peers from so many competitors and teams, and not just his teammates but guys around the league. So tough announcement there, but it's something you might want to check out on social media, on Twitter, et cetera. All right, so we got plenty of questions. Let's get to it.
All right, we'll start back with the baseball news of the week. And Mike asked, are you surprised that none of the Astros players were suspended? And do you think the organization should keep their 2017 championship banner up?
Well, I mean, I think the baseball could have made them vacate that title. And, you know, like I said earlier, that doesn't mean that the Dodgers get it or some other team gets it. But you could certainly erase from the history books and their stadium any mention of the fact that they won that World Series, because we know now they cheated to win the World Series. And there's just no way around that. You know, it's not as if you could go back and say, well, you know, the other team was stealing signs too. Like, this is not the steroid era where you can say, you know, the only one team used steroids and no one on the other team did. I mean, it's not that sort of thing. So I mean, I think they could vacate it, and they didn't. I don't think any professional sports league has done that. We've seen it in colleges with certain awards. I mean, you know, they didn't give the Heisman Trophy to Vince Young when Reggie Bush had it taken away from him, right? But he vacated the Heisman Trophy that year. So, you know, for all of history, he's not in possession of it, and there's no Heisman Trophy winner for the year that Reggie Bush won it. But I don't remember anything like that happening in the NHL or NBA or anywhere else. So it's not going to happen here.
It seems like college is the only one that does that.
Yeah, college does it. Yes, colleges do, and they also have postseason bans. Colleges are prone to do that very often when they have teams that are you know, found to be with ineligible players or what have you. You know, just short of the death penalty where you can't play at all.
And they've had that before too.
Yeah, they've actually taken, you know, a program off the field where they couldn't play at all. But I'm not advocating that. I think they could have had a postseason ban, which would then affect the players, like we mentioned earlier. That might be something that'd be difficult to do because of their bonuses, and players' union would rail against it. But I do think players should have been held accountable. And I don't know, you know, again, I think baseball needed the information, and I think that they sort of, you know, blanket gave immunity to these guys so that they could find out exactly how widespread it was and what the mechanisms were and try to prevent it in the future. But I'm sorry, man. I'm always going to look at Jose Altuve different. I'm always going to look at those guys. And I think, you know, it'll be something they'll have to reckon with when they come up for Hall of Fame voting or any other things like that. I think, you know, it's not, like I said, this is not necessarily the steroid type, you know, thing where baseball looked the other way and everybody was doing it. We don't know how widespread it was. It might be more widespread than just one or two teams for sure. But when you look at the home and away batting averages of some of those players, it's telling to me. And, you know, the best thing the Astros can do is go out and start about 20-5 or 25-7 this year. And at that point, people will say, well, they'll say one of two things. Either they found a new way to cheat, or they were pretty damn good anyway, and it really, you know, really wasn't that big of a deal. But let them go the other way. Let them struggle, you know. Let some of those players have career horrible years at the plate, and then people will be really riled up and say, you know, aha, you know, they needed that crutch. That's the reason why they were so successful. So, but I don't understand why players weren't held more accountable. You know, like I said, just to, and for that matter, the ownership. You know, the ownership, it should start with them, and, you know, firing a couple guys and paying $5 million, even if that's the most they can find them, just doesn't seem to be enough. But they'll wear the scarlet letter. They'll have the stain of that. You know, the Astros or the Asterix now, the Houston Asterix, that's going to be played. It wouldn't surprise me if they get, you know, players are booed in other stadiums. I mean, this is going to be a thing for a while. And like I said, we still don't know how widespread it was. We don't know, you know, if the Red Sox, you know, deployed similar tactics during their World Series win.
Well, Carl asked, in your opinion, what is the worst scandal of baseball? Is it the Black Sox, Pete Rose, steroid era, video cheating, segregation of black players?
Well, I mean, I don't know. The segregation of black players, you know, sort of mirrored what the, you know, society was. And it was egregious, obviously, and you know, credit to Jackie Robinson for Blake, you know, him breaking the color barrier, and it was an embarrassing time in our nation. So I don't know that it was unique to baseball. There were a lot of industries and society in general, was segregated. So that's part of our history in this country. The Black Sox scandal was, you know, gambling on a World Series, especially to lose it, is probably as bad as anything could be. I think, we didn't live in the early 1900s, so I don't really have anything to compare it to. For me, the worst thing that's happened to baseball in my lifetime was the steroid era, because baseball was complicit. And we talked about this, you and I, Steve, just the other night, where these owners were well aware of what was going on. I mean,
everybody
Mark McGuire had Androstenedione, or whatever it was called, Andro, in his locker. And everybody knew what was going on. You could see the inflated bodies and hat sizes for Barry Bonds. I mean, they knew it was happening, and they were benefiting from it. They were making millions of dollars. I mean, in some ways, the home run race was with Aguirre and Sosa at that time, they said, saved baseball. So, they were so complicit in that I think that's the worst scandal, because there wasn't anybody, really sounding the alarms the way they should have. And then, of course, it until they went to Washington, it was, they were threatened with their antitrust, losing that. Then all of a sudden they got religion and said, oh, this is horrible for baseball. Let's get it out of our game. So to me, that's the worst one, because, baseball is a sport that probably reveres its records and its numbers more than any other sport. And there's no way to sort of quantify how much a guy benefited his career totals, guys like we've talked about, Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds, and what you do with them, what you do with that era, and not knowing who was on it and who was not using it. So to me, that's been the worst of my lifetime anyway.
I might say it's the video cheating. The only reason is because everyone knew the steroid era was happening. Maybe it wasn't reported, but everybody
but
in
see,
baseball knew
that's what's
knew
so
it.
Horrible about
everybody
it
Everybody knew
me,
it, and everybody basically said, it's okay, we're making a lot of money off this.
But see, that's what bothers me about it. Baseball itself was complicit. Like, it wasn't right. Just like you had one manager betting, Pete Rose, right? Your manager mm-hmm. betting on his own team. How mm-hmm. awful is that? Everybody in baseball knew about it, and to me, that's the biggest stain on the game, because they were part of it.
Well, but and many were doing it too. I mean, so yes. as you talked about earlier, is it's not like one team had the advantage over the other because one was doing it, one
no,
wasn't.
You're right.
And granted, I don't know how many was, and it's not saying everybody right. was, but
you're right about that. Yeah, competitively, it was probably level, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there was probably some on every team.
Yeah, comparing record wise, it wasn't, but competing against other teams is. Look, everyone knew that if you want to take steroids, you're not going to get busted, because baseball's not doing a thing about it.
That's correct.
Everyone knew that. Now, it was your choice whether you wanted to do it or not. Some players did, some didn't. Some we know about, some we don't.
Yeah.
But, to me, it affected the game, absolutely, but I don't know if there was a competitive disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
This video cheating is a competitive disadvantage from what the Astros have done and what the Red Sox are alleged to have done, and maybe others, we'll find out. But I mean, that is a distinct advantage that you're trying to gain, that's explicitly been, come down from the commissioner's office, you're not allowed to do, and they still did it.
And an advantage to the point where not only did they benefited to the point of winning the damn World Series.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so they took this thing all the way to the top, right?
Yeah. And you still wonder, and I saw you answer a tweet this morning. Was Glasnow tipping his pitches, or were the Astros cheating? And as you said, it might be both.
Might be a little
both. We know
yeah.
Glasnow was tipping his pitches. It was pretty obvious once, if someone yes. told you, look at his arm position. It was obvious. Curveball, fastball. His arms were completely different positions. It was pretty easy to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean the Astros weren't cheating as well. And
they're not exclusive.
Game five, you lost because Glasnow tipped his pitches. But game one and two, you wonder.
Mm-hmm.
Because also at the Trop, the Rays dominated the Astros. Now, some of that's home field, some of that's, there's a lot of things that go into it. But
as I recall, too, Glasnow did not throw a complete game that day.
No. Well, no. I mean,
so
he
there
was,
were other
yeah,
there were other guys
going
that
to,
came but. In the game. The game wasn't over just because their first six guys reached.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they if they were cheating, they continued to cheat no matter who the Rays brought in after him.
Right. So, but they didn't hit him very hard after that, though. But the Rays just didn't score enough offense in that game five. So
right.
When they couldn't overcome that deficit they got early from Glasnow. So.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Mike asked, what changes could teams like the Rays deploy to make it harder for the next round of cheaters?
I have to give this some real thought. I don't know what the Rays can do per se. I mean, I guess you could somehow assign somebody to sort of monitor as best you can that sort of thing. Or
maybe we'll see like football teams, you know, they'll be in the dugout, they'll be holding up four different cards of, you know, a logo of a different, you know, sports franchise, right. A panda bear, this and you have about three different players in different color jerseys giving different signs, and you know, only the batter or the pitcher knows which one's the real one.
Yeah,
maybe we'll start seeing that in baseball.
Maybe. We see a lot of, you know, pitchers stepping back and I think you said this the other night too, Steve, which is a great point. I mean, they want to speed up the game, but now, mm-hmm. I mean, how much antenna, this is a question that lends itself to this. How much effort will teams spend or opposing pitchers? Like, it's, you know, I'm a pitcher on the mound and I'm playing the Astros or the Red Sox, or I'm playing anybody that I suspect might be cheating. I'm going to be listening for every whistle.
Mm-hmm.
Every bang, every rhythmic clap, everything I can think of, and then I'm going to start pointing at the dugout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's really going to be interesting to see, you know, sort of how teams do go about combating this, and certainly, you know, changing your signs is one way.
There's some talk of, do you put a communication system between the pitcher and the catcher? Where the pitcher, you know, the catcher has an earpiece
fastball,
in essentially
slider,
from, you know, and he just puts his glove over his mouth and says fastball.
Well,
fastball and outside. And you know, there's no signs. Now, your infielders don't know what the sign is, and they usually like to know that too.
Well, that's the thing. I was going to say, like, you need to communicate that really to everybody. And so how many transmit? Like, football does it, and,
well,
you know, this was the thing.
Yeah, just the quarterback or just the one defensive player.
It's just the quarterback. And I've always wondered, like, how come somebody can't pick that off electronically? How come I can't find the frequency to monitor that, right, in a stadium? But apparently it works. Apparently, as far as we know anyway, nobody has intercepted those from opposing teams. And it's, you know, the helmet communicator is the thing. So, yeah, I mean, again, technology is going to advance itself to where it might actually solve some of these problems as much as it's caused them. But I don't know how that would go. I don't know if you could... You know, I mean, I always thought it was funny, and, you know, this is the thing, right? When they go to the mound, everybody covers their mouth with their glove because they think everyone else is such a great lip reader that they can tell exactly what they're talking about and which pitch they're going to throw next. Didn't you find that to be interesting? When they're up there in a huddle around the mound and the guy's saying, hey, Joe, throw strikes, or hey, let's work them this way or that way, that they're... That they think there's a bunch of are there lip readers employed by these teams?
You know? If it could give them a competitive advantage, they sure would.
But they must think that, right? Mm-hmm. Why are you covering your mouth with your glove when you're talking to the pitcher or the pitching coach who's right. You know, 5 inches away from you?
But that would be a legal way to steal a sign or whatever else. Because as long as you're not using some special camera that you're zoomed in. Or, you know, with a microphone
or
something.
Well, the TV broadcast would help,
but,
right?
I mean, the TV usually shows them on the mound. And,
right.
You know, or
that's
you, could,
what I mean.
You could be standing on first base, you know, the hitter on first base and, you know, look, you know, being able to see the pitcher say, I mean, you read coaches' lips all the time on TV. They don't like a call. You can definitively read what they're saying.
Well, because I swear a lot and I know exactly what they're saying. But did you know that if you mouth the words, love you much, it sounds exactly like SOB? Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah, so you got to be careful with lip reading.
So in other words, when we think they're calling an official an SOB, they're actually saying love you much.
Try it one time. Say, look, stand in front of a mirror and mouth the words. It looks a lot like SOB, I'm just saying. So you can be wrong.
Wow.
Yeah.
But then we don't
know
get
how
the,
I know
we don't
that.
Get the, you know, but the problem is everyone covers their mouths. We don't get those great lip reading videos that they do.
That's true.
It's usually it's the NFL they do it on, you know, players and coaches and that, and they're hilarious.
Right. I have no trouble reading the NFL coaches, though, on the sidelines. Like the divisional playoffs? Mm-hmm. There were some really good ones.
Yes.
There were some great ones, man. Those guys.
And Pete Carroll
I really am surprised at times. I truly mean this, that the side judges that are next to these coaches, that they don't just throw the flag up in the air when they're like, oh, that's enough. You know what I mean? Because, I mean, I don't know really where the line is. Like, if you bring in relatives to your profanity, is that the line? You know, or mothers? Like, what is – it seems as if they can say almost anything.
I think if you're – I think for the most part, because – and I've been around this in college basketball a lot where you can get really close.
Yeah.
And, you know, I worked with Bob Huggins for years. And, you know,
he
was
had a
all
few
over
technicals.
The officials. Absolutely. Usually the line is you can be upset at calls, you can be upset at non-calls. It's
Got
when
it.
You start insulting
personally
them
attacking
or,
them.
Yeah. You know, you're having a bad day, why don't you get glasses? You know, you start doing those kind of things.
Okay.
You know, if you're going, come on, what was that call? You know, he didn't foul, he didn't, you know, usually the one demonstrative, but.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and granted, in basketball, it's you have probably a better relationship than even in football, but they kind of know each other too. So, you know, a lot of it is built up over time.
True.
And, you know where the line is with each official. I mean, you know, believe me, when it came to the Bearcats basketball, I mean, you know, Chuck Mayshock, who was the assistant for Huggins for years and was one of Huggins' coaches when Huggins was a player, and he did the radio broadcast. We talked about him a week or two ago when he passed away. But, you know, going in the game, he's like, oh, it's going to be a bad night. Look, this official, I mean, you know, he goes, Huggins is going to have a short leash. He would know already. He already knew that Huggins was going to have a short leash. Huggins might get thrown out of this game. I mean, you know, you just knew it based on who the officials were.
You know, Phil Esposito is always talking about the, he knows the, you know, all the officials, all the referees, or what do you call them in hockey?
Yeah, the linesmen and the referees.
The linesmen and the referees. And he'll say, oh, this guy, you know, and he knows.
Francois St. Laurent never gave us a call. Never gives the Lightning a call. Never.
That's right. He knows.
Especially if you're playing Montreal. Oh, you'll get nothing.
That's what you got to study those officials.
You get nothing and you'll like it.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, I think it's those lines, it varies from an official. I mean, you know. But most of the time, it's if you're going to complain about what happened on the field and why this call and why you think it was wrong, they pretty much let it go. But you start going, you know, did you get enough sleep last night? Or, you know, you start ripping them, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, if you start calling them names, probably. But it depends on the official, probably. I mean, you know, they know each other most of the time. So.
Yeah.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, we got some football questions now, and UK Bucks asks, Rick, out of the 8 teams who appeared in wildcard rounds and the 8 teams who then appeared in the divisional round, how many of those teams had 2 interceptions or more in the game? The answer is 1 out of 16. So does this not further highlight the issue with Winston's multiple INTs?
Well, it does. I mean, I think turnovers in general, you know, the Baltimore Ravens, I think, had 4, if I'm not mistaken. And we saw a bunch of turnovers, you know, in the AFC as well. Yeah, I mean, it does. And whether it's interceptions or turnovers, when you get to that level, when you get to the playoff level, you're playing teams that are good, right? You're not one of the 12 entering the playoffs unless you're a very good team. And when you make mistakes, you know, the NFL is as much, you know, as many games are lost as there are won, right, by mistakes. So you make mistakes. You know, we heard it last year, Bruce Arians saying, you know, Bucks beating Bucks. I mean, he felt like even at the end of the year, we asked him what will be different next season. He says, we'll have a team that's not going to beat itself. And that's just part of football. And sometimes guys make good plays and get the ball out. And other times, more often than not, it's just, you know, a player making a mistake and putting the ball in harm's way or fumbling or whatever. But that's what happens. You know, those teams that are in the playoffs, they typically don't get there if they're careless with the football. So am I surprised that only one of the you know, of the 16 games, there was a game with two interceptions? No, because you don't get there without taking care of the ball. And we've seen, whether it's Ryan Tannehill, I mean, name the quarterbacks, Russell Wilson. I mean, if you look at the touchdown interception ratio to these guys, it's incredible, right? it's no accident. They handle the ball every play, and they will themselves. Aaron Rodgers, I think, has the greatest, you know, touchdown interception ratio in the history of the league, of the NFL. I mean, he just almost never turns it over with an interception. So that's exactly it. I mean, as they say, you know, the game, it's so important. You know, the football is so important, they named the game after it. And I think that it's the reason why, a big reason why the Bucs haven't won or didn't win more games last year. And I would be curious what would happen if they did get in the postseason, because I assure you this, that if they turn the ball over, they would lose, because, you know, just like hockey, you know, every mistake you make, it seems like it ends up in the back of the net. Well, that's what playoff football is. Every mistake you make, it ends up on the scoreboard, either, you know, best case scenario, field goal and or a touchdown. So that is something that Jameis will have to get better at, or his team will not be in the postseason. And if he does get there, when the stakes are really high, and every mistake is magnified, you wonder how far he could take a team, because you know, you have to play pretty much error free football at that point. So that's going to affect his career until he can get rid of it.
Les asked, since three of the final four teams are very good defensively, do you think that the Bucs should spend more money on that side of the ball this offseason? Watching the 49ers, I really want Shaq and JPP back. Pass rush is a must in 2020, especially in this division.
Well, they're going to have to. I think that's where most of the money will be spent, and that's because the reason they're spending money on it now is because they didn't draft forever on that side of the ball. And so when you don't draft and develop players, you end up having spent a lot of money on free agents, and you make up for your mistakes in the draft that way. So, you know, while John Lynch, when he went into San Francisco, built that football team with a bunch of, you know, high draft picks, first round picks on their defensive line, that's why those guys are elite. You know, he invested resources in terms of draft picks and built them the right way. The Bucs, with the exception of Vita Vea, who has, I think, become a pretty good player, largely were unable to draft and develop guys. You know, I mean, up until last year, Gerald McCoy was still one of their top defensive linemen. So they've had to go out in the draft in free agency, or go outside the draft in free agency, or claim guys off waivers like Carl Nassib, and try to make up for simply not choosing defensive linemen over the past several years. And so that's why JPP is here. But you pay a huge amount of money for those guys. And you know, good for them. They got Shaq Barrett 1 year, $4 million, and he led the freaking NFL in sacks with 19.5. The bad news is they didn't know he was that good, or they assigned him to a 2 or 3 year contract, and now they're going to have to pay some $18 to $20 million a year for this guy, or somewhere between $16 and $19 million a year anyway. You know, so in JPP, same thing. He was making $12.5-13 million. You know, they tore up his contract because of his cervical injury to his neck. But he came in and he played 10 games and had 8.5 sacks. Now, you know, the question is, you know, what is a guy that's now 31 years old with the hand, you know, the hand injury, the neck injury, the knee injury that prevents him from practicing the last half of the year? You know, how much is he worth? How much is Carl Nassib worth? So they're going to have to spend a lot of money on defense, because they simply don't have defensive linemen outside of Vita Vea. I mean, Bo Allen's not going to be back. He's a free agent. So, yeah, I would say that the money they spend, and they have some $94 million under salary cap with the exception of the quarterback position, most, if not all of it, will be spent on defense.
Steve asks, you're the GM of the Bucs, and you only have enough money to franchise one player and let the other walk. You have to choose between Jameis Winston and Shaq Barrett. Who do you sign and who do you let walk?
Well, first of all, congratulations to me. I didn't know I was the GM of the Bucs, and since I am, I'm going to enjoy my lifestyle for a while and not tell you what the hell I'm going to do. No. I have wrestled with this question, and I don't, you know, first of all, it's not a binary choice, right? I mean, the goal would be to try to sign one of them. And you know, it'd be nice if you could do it with the quarterback, but I think it's a little harder calculus, to be honest with you. I think within some range you could probably know where Shaq Barrett's deal is going to come in. Now, Shaq Barrett may disagree, and that's the trick, right? You got to have two people that agree on his value. And his value not just to the rest of the NFL, but to your team. But there is something to be said for not having to move your family. There's something to be said for Shaq Barrett knowing that he was very effective in this defensive scheme under Todd Bowles. The fact that he likes his teammates and they seem to play well off each other. All those things are sort of a home field advantage. Now, that doesn't mean you get a hometown discount necessarily, but I do think that you have a better chance maybe of reaching a long-term extension with a Shaq Barrett because a couple things. One, you recognize he deserves to be paid. He's earned his money. He went out there on a one-year make-it contract, and, buddy, he made it. He made it so big, and you were the beneficiary of that to the tune of 19 and a half sacks. You can't deny the guys, earn the money. So you feel good about it, right? He's 27. He's not 31. So, I mean, he's got a lot left in the tank. He didn't play every down in Denver for those 5 years, and he wants to be great. So all those things you feel good about. So you're proud. You're happy to give guys like that the free agent contract. So I think you have a better chance of getting him done before free agency, and that's where I would put my attention. The franchise tag, I think, almost has to go on the quarterback if you want him back. And I wrote a column about this in the Tampa Bay Times. You can read it on tampabay.com. The word is on the street, as they say. Now, the Bucs have not actually began official talks with Joel Siegel, Jameis Winston's agent. But it's been put out there by somebody, and they have done nothing to refute it, including respond to my emails about this very subject, which is the belief is that Jameis Winston and his people, whoever those people are, whether that's his agent, his dad, his representatives, I don't know, his friends, his wife, I don't know who the people are. But the word is that he expects to be paid, and he expects to be paid handsomely and for multi-years and guaranteed. If you're Jameis Winston or you're in his camp, you're saying, now is the time, to get my generational money. I've played 5 years in this league. I played under the one-year club option, which was not a poverty rate. I mean, you made $21 million, right? But I'm done with my rookie contract, and I have just led the NFL in passing yardage, and I threw a team record that I expanded on my own record, 33 touchdowns. Oh, yeah, there was this thing about the 30 interceptions. But we can go back and look at the tape, and I can show you, five or 10 of them, whatever, that weren't on me, okay? First near you in the system. I can cut this thing up any way you want to. The bottom line is this. This is my chance, right? I play the game because I love it and because I'm passionate about it, but I'm also a professional, and I may only be a free agent one time in my life. And I'm confident that if I were in free agency at 26 years old, with all that I've accomplished, that there's going to be a team out there that's going to guarantee me $28 to $30 million. And that's sort of the number we're hearing. It's not, the franchise tag's 27, right? So why would you go below that? If you're going to guarantee Kirk Cousins $84 million, then if I'm Jameis Winston at 26, he's 31, he hasn't won anything. He's been to one playoff game, won it. He's 1-2. He's been in three. He's 1-2 in the playoffs. I've been to no playoff games, but that's because I was drafted number one to the worst team in the NFL. Then I'm going to say, hey, pay me and pay me now. So I don't think the Bucs are going to have an easy negotiation for multi-years. One, I don't know if they're committed to him for more than 1 year. I think they would be a part of me if I was a GM, since you just made me GM, that would say, hey, am I sure he's not going to throw 25 next year? Am I that sure to give him a 2 or 3 year deal now? Or do I just, franchise him and he gives us the best chance to win as a starting quarterback and he has to go out there and prove that he can cut down on his interceptions and we can win games and win a Super Bowl with him? And then if he does that, then I can either franchise him again or I can then work on a multi-year deal a year from now when I have more information about how he's going to perform in this system in his second year. How much improvement does he make? So I guess that's a long way of saying I think that they're absolutely not going to let Shaq Barrett out of Tampa, no matter what. But I also believe that if they plan on keeping Jameis based on what he wants and maybe what some of their reservations might be, that you'd almost have to use the franchise tag on the quarterback and not the edge rusher. Because the edge rusher, within a few million dollars between friends, we can probably come to an agreement on what his market value would be if he were in free agency. And we may be wrong, but ultimately, like I said, it's between the player. The player has to agree to it. The team has to agree to it. But that's my thinking that might occur. I think they would go very hard because even if you go, let's say you get to a point where you can't reach an agreement with Jameis. First of all, Jameis isn't going to be successful if they don't have a good defense, right? So whoever the quarterback is, you got to stop people. And the best part of their defense is what Shaq Barrett did. And they get improved, and they're number one against the run. And so I need Ndamukong Suh. I need Jason Pierre-Paul or Carl Nassib. I need those guys for any quarterback to be successful on my football team, especially Jameis. So, you know, it's almost more important that you re-sign Shaq Barrett right now, and then regardless of the quarterback, I got to have a good defense, and then I can decide, well, if I can't, you know, if I don't want Jameis, I'll move on, or if we can't reach a long-term agreement that works for both of us, then I'll franchise him. So I think that's where we're leaning if he comes back as a franchise tag. That's just the way I feel about it. And again, I don't know what they're going to do. I think it is still undecided, and I think it is something that evolves, and it's a living, breathing thing, and every day they'll get more information about who the free agents are actually going to be at the quarterback position and who they think they can actually sign.
Well, Gerald asks, has Jameis Winston's camp indicated that he would hold out if he was franchise tagged?
Not to my knowledge. They haven't indicated anything. They're simply running deep, running silent. Again, I don't think there's been a discussion with the Bucs and his representatives about, you know, whether he doesn't want the franchise tag. Here's the thing. There's reports about it, and we've all heard it, and the Bucs have heard it. And the Bucs are trying to figure out what teams, you know, is there a big market out there for Jameis Winston? I mean, look, it only takes one, right? I mean, if San Diego or somebody that, you know, moves on from Phillip Rivers after 16 years says, you know what, we really like that quarterback in Tampa. We have a good defense. We think we can run the ball. You know what? I want Jameis Winston. He's 26. Let's pay that guy. And then it's done, right? On the other hand, I went through all the teams, and it's hard to find, you know, a team where you go, aha, there's a team that would take. You know, the team that's the most likely, seriously, when you look at their situation, the Carolina Panthers,
I was just going to say that,
might be the team that's the most likely fit for Jameis Winston. They have a new owner. They have a new head coach in Matt Rhule who has a 7-year contract, so he ain't going anywhere. So they're going to want a young quarterback to start over with, right? They have a decision to make with Cam Newton, but they can walk away from Cam Newton, who has been just injury after injury the last few years. It only costs them $2 million against their salary cap. It's not a big price to pay, and it gives them an extra, I don't know, $20 million or you know, thereabouts, $18 million anyway, on, you know, to spend in free agency. So you lose a couple million, but you gain the rest of it, of his salary. That's not the portion that's not guaranteed. So to me, of the teams I looked at, I mean, Chicago's not going anywhere at Trubisky. Yeah, Miami has potentially could move on from Josh Rosen and Ryan Fitzpatrick, but they have a high draft pick. You know, that's the other thing. A lot of these teams that need quarterbacks, Cincinnati, Miami, you know, they're in position to draft one. So I don't think he fits there with the kind of money that he's hoping to make. So, you know, that's the thing. There has to be a market for him. Whether there will be, there's other free agents available. I mean, you know, is Tom Brady going back to the New England Patriots? Is Drew Brees going to play another year for the Saints? Well, if he doesn't, then maybe Teddy Bridgewater is off the market because they go hard and re-sign him. So it's a living, moving thing. And while the Bucs may have met as a staff and there might be, you know, one guy wants him back, wants Jameis back. Another guy isn't so sure. One guy wants to move on. I mean, you know, you have varying opinions when you get a group of people together. But the only one that matters really is the ownership. And, They have to trust their coaches and their GM, you know, to address the position, whether it's with Jameis or somebody else. So I don't think we'll hear what their decision is until they make one. In other words, I think this is going to go all the way to free agency. I think you'll hear stories that they're moving on. I think you'll hear stories that they're trying to sign them to a big long-term deal. I think you'll hear that they may franchise them. And ultimately, once we get to free agency, we'll know whether he gets out there as a free agent or they sign someone else when the free agent signing period starts. And that's going to be probably the only time we know for sure what the 2020 quarterback position is going to look like here in Tampa.
Ellis asked, in the 2019 season, which Buccaneer player made the most improvement? Who was an underachiever and who was the biggest surprise?
Well, the biggest surprise, I mean, I think we just talked about him, Shaq Barrett. Even Shaq Barrett was surprised what Shaq Barrett did. I mean, because, you know, his goal was double digits, right? I mean, that's something that had only been done here once since 2005, and it was done a year earlier by JPP with 12 and a half sacks. So when he came in, you know, he had 14 career sacks. Listen to what I said now. 14 career sacks in five seasons with the Denver Broncos. Now, you know, he played behind DeMarcus Ware and Von Miller and, you know, Chubb and those guys. So it was hard for him to get on the field. But to say that even he expected to have anything close to this, he's been very adamant about it. No, I didn't see this coming. But he went out and got nine in the first four games. So that put him in a pretty good place. And what I liked about it is that he finished so strong. So Shaq Barrett, I think, was a big surprise. Most improved, you know, it would be hard not to say a guy like Chris Godwin, who was a very, very good receiver and turned into be a Pro Bowl receiver, right?
Mm-hmm.
Led the team in catches, over 1,000 yards. You know, I think Bruce Arians saw that. I mean, had he stayed healthy the last three games that he missed with a hamstring, you wonder what those numbers would have been. I think he would have been over 1,500 yards. I really do. You might have had a couple 1,500-yard receivers with Mike Evans. You know, the guy that I thought really got better in a big way was Vita Vea. I thought Vita Vea was dominant at times, and it's not a numbers position, right? It's not a position where you might necessarily have a lot of sacks or a lot of tackles. But if you watch the number of people they had to commit to blocking and see the penetration that he got and the way they were number one against the run. And that doesn't happen unless Vita Vea and Ndamukong Suh are you know, blocking up the middle of that field and keeping those linebackers clean. So I think, you know, that's a big part of it right there. All right, my underachiever is no longer with the Tampa Bay Bucs because he underachieved so much, and that's Vernon Hargraves. I mean, there was so much expected of him. You know, they went to the man-to-man coverage, what he thrived in, and was a starter to begin the season. He made a big play, certainly against Carolina, you know, with his stop of Christian McCaffrey that won the game on fourth down. But then after that, you know, he just gave up too many big plays. And I think when they got rid of him, that team got better. And it got better because they were able to play Jamel Dean. Carlton Davis, of course, had a good year. He was very improved. He could be one of those most improved guys, too, that you could mention. And Sean Murphy Bunting got on the field. And when you look at where Sean Murphy Bunting was sort of a deer in the headlights in that first preseason game at Pittsburgh to what he became later in the year, I think he led the team with three interceptions, and you had the big, pick six in Detroit, and you know, pointing to his family and friends there in Michigan in the end zone. I mean, that was a picture of improvement there. But Hargraves, reason why he's not here anymore, he underachieved, and I would say that he was probably the biggest disappointment.
All right, the Super Bowl is coming up, and Buck North asked, Rick, what's your most memorable Super Bowl that you've covered, and which venue was your favorite, and what is the best and worst part of media day at the Super Bowl?
All right, those are great questions. I've done more than 25 of these. I know that dates me, but they're all special in their own way, especially the ones that have been in Tampa. We've had some really good games here, you know, going back to really Super Bowl 18 and the Raiders, and that wasn't a close game, but it was interesting to see Al Davis and the run by Marcus Allen and all of that. Of course, the one between the Patriots and the Bills, and I believe that the Whitney Houston, you know,
the national anthem,
Star-Spangled Banner, yeah. National anthem was amazing during that time where the Gulf War was going on. The most memorable game, I'll start with that. I think it was It was the comeback by Tom Brady against the Atlanta Falcons. I'm sorry. I mean, that you know, it'll always haunt the Falcons. What were they up, 24-3?
28-3.
28-3, that's right, 28-3. And from a working standpoint, you know, the deadlines are really tough and no one cares. But I was really happy that it was going to be a blowout. I was ready to write that this is the end of the Patriots dynasty. And remember, Tom Brady threw a pick six and he sprawled out all over the carpet there and – you know, and watching them run it in for a touchdown to go down 28-3 or whatever. And I was ready to pronounce that you know, that it was over. It was done. That he was old, all that stuff. And, of course, we know what happened next. Then it looked like, well, it's going to be a close game, but the Falcons are going to win. And so I had that story up. And then finally it became, oh, geez, the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history. You know, the GOAT did it again. But just an amazing game, tragic for one team. You know, of course, you know, Brady was at his very best, and some of the plays in that game were just phenomenal. I mean, there were others, obviously, you know, when it seems like it always involved the Patriots, when the Seahawks and the Patriots played and the Seahawks were on the goal line and you thought they would give it to beast mode, and you had the shocking interception by Malcolm Butler, and you know, that was memorable from a game standpoint. Favorite venue, this may surprise people, I don't really know, because I only did one game there. It's the Rose Bowl. It was a Super Bowl between Dallas and Buffalo, one of the last ones they played, and I think that was the Don Beebe game or whatever, but that was when Dallas just annihilated the Bills. But what was memorable about it was the Rose Bowl. If you've ever been there, you should try to go in Pasadena. It's just... it's a phenomenal location, right? And you got the mountains, and, you know, it was late in the afternoon there. Much of the game was played, you know, near sunset or whatever because of the West Coast time. But in the halftime entertainment, by the way, was Michael Jackson, which was phenomenal. I mean, he did magic, like he appeared at a different part of the building. And then, you know, that was back in the day when you know, he had been on with the Motown 25th or whatever it was, anniversary or 100th anniversary. I don't know what it was, but he was as hot as he could be with a Thriller album and Off the Wall and all that. To see him perform, to see that venue. Again, the game wasn't memorable. The Cowboys won, I think, their second Super Bowl under Jimmy Johnson. But that was fun. It was a lot of fun. So I've had a bunch of them. They're all good. They're all unique in their own way. But those come to mind just off the top of my head.
All right, Les asked, 42 points were scored against that Clemson defense. Does that mean Clemson's overrated, or was LSU just that good? Heck, they dropped 42 on Florida, and they didn't have 17 days to prepare.
I don't think Clemson was overrated. I mean, I think LSU was that good. I mean, they did things just from a team standpoint that, you know, people are arguing, are they the greatest college football team ever? Do they have the greatest season? As far as the greatest team, I mean, you might get an argument from the 2001 Miami Hurricanes when you look at the talent that they had. But what didn't they win, right? I mean, they brought home the Heisman Trophy, the Coach of the Year, the Walter Camp, the Maxwell Award, the Davey Bryan Award, the Johnny Unitas SEC Player of the Year. You know, I mean, Blitnikoff Award to the best receiver in Jamar Chase. I mean, the Thorpe Award, they had the best defensive back in Grant Delpit. I mean, there wasn't anything. And then Burrow had the greatest singular season of any quarterback in college football history, through 60 touchdowns, including four, you know, touchdowns in the national championship game, which is an all-time NCAA record. He ran for another score. So that's just how good that LSU was. They
were seven top 10 teams.
Seven top 10 teams, yeah.
Beat all four top four preseason AP teams.
Incredible, right? Yeah, no, this was a special year for LSU. And look, you know what's and you know how you know this is, you talk about Clemson being overrated. Look, if Clemson wins this game, that's three out of four national championships, right? I mean, Dabo Swinney is the best coach in college football, one of the best in history. That's the best. I mean, think about this class, right, that would have won. So you came in as a freshman. You won, you know, three national championships out of 4 years, lost the other one. would have been, you know, had a 30-game winning streak to end your career. I mean, all those things were on the line for Clemson, and everybody thought that would, you know, ingrain them as the greatest college football team ever because of what that class accomplished. So that's who you beat and beat handily. It's not on Clemson, folks. It's on LSU and what they were able to do. It's just a super year by them. All right, some great questions. Hope you enjoyed the answers on our mailbag. You don't have to wait for a mailbag segment. You can send us questions anytime. Reach us on Twitter at SportsDayTB. You can reach me on Twitter at NFLStroud. Or my email address is rstroud@tampabay.com. Tomorrow we'll preview the NFL Championship weekend. Titans at Chiefs, Packers at 49ers, and it's on to Super Bowl 54 in Miami. The Lightning are at Minnesota to begin their back-to-back as they then move on to Winnipeg after that. And they got, what'd you say, Steve, the sixth best record in hockey now?
They do. They're tied with the Islanders for fifth best, but the Islanders have a game in hand. So for all those people that wrote them off earlier in the season, they are now they're actually fifth in the East because the Blues are the only team in the top six from the West. But they're sitting pretty well right now.
And when you mean all those people, you're specifically talking to me because I thought they weren't going to get it done. Hey, folks, if you have a chance, go out to Tampa Bay Downs. I mean, this has been one of the best landmarks in Tampa Bay since 1926. And, you know, in addition to thoroughbred horse racing, which they have every Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, there's a lot of other things you can do out there. You can work on your golf game, you know, at their Tampa Bay Downs golf practice facility. You can play some poker in the Silks Poker Room. They've really got something for everybody. And, of course, the thoroughbred racing, which is every, as I said, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday. The gates open at 11 a.m. Post time is 12:25, and the excitement is always fast and fun. Tampa Bay Downs, you bet they run. You can call Tampa Bay Downs at 813-855-4401. For Steve Versnick, I'm Rick Stroud of the Tampa Bay Times. Have a great day, everybody.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.